Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. On the program today, a parliamentary vaccine mandate showdown. All MPs will need to be double vaxxed to enter Parliament on November 22nd, but why do the Conservatives disagree with that new rule? How many of their MPs will actually be able to show up for work? How many remain unvaccinated? MPs are here to debate that in just a few moments. And does Parliament need to be come back earlier to get to work? Today, the Prime Minister met with leaders from the Conservatives, the NDP, and the Green Party. What happened? Well, NDP leader Jagmeet Singh is standing by for a press conference. We will go there live when that happens. Then, rising inflation costs spikes to an 18-year high. Canada's inflation rate hits the highest level since 2003. The consumer price index shot up 4.4% in September. Gas, food, rent, everything's getting higher. What does it mean for the big promises of a recovery? Should the federal support programs be stopped or extended? We'll break all that down for you in the press gallery. Plus, taxing your sweets. Newfoundland and Labrador wants to bring in Canada's first sugar tax. How much will that soda pop cost you? Will it really improve health, or is this a tax on sugary drinks, just a cash grab for the government? We'll bring in the Premier of Newfoundland and Labrador, Andrew Fury. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. Well, you already know it's happening. You see it everywhere, at the gas station, at the grocery store. High prices. After 18 years, the inflation genie is out of the bottle. That's right. StatsCan says the consumer price index rose 4.4% in September compared to a year ago. Driving that, of course, prices at the pump. Get this. Consumers paid nearly 33% more last month than in September 2020. Beef, 13% up. Chicken, 10% up. Pork, 9%. Cars, 7.5%. So, will there be any respite in sight for Canadian pocketbooks, and could inflation threaten Canada's post-pandemic recovery? We begin our coverage with BNN Bloomberg's Greg Bunnell. Greg, 6 months straight of inflation readings above the Bank of Canada's inflation target range, which is about 2%. What is driving the inflation?
It's got to be getting hard, Evan, for the Bank of Canada to keep telling us, don't worry, these price pressures, as you said, we feel it. Grocery shopping, filling up the car, putting a roof over our heads, that they're transitory, that it's just an effect of the economy reopening. It's all going to sort of go away, and we're going to be just fine. We're seeing, coming out of the pandemic, the demand that has returned. And this is what we're hoping for, right, in terms of what you're talking about, an economic recovery. Once we're freer to do things and engage in society, we will spend that money and the economy will recover from the worst of the pandemic. But now you got these shipping chain disruptions. The price of moving freight around the world is just soaring. You're seeing a lot of companies come out and simply say, we don't know if we can meet consumer demand because of a various amount of factors, not only the cost of that shipping, but the fact that in parts of the world where some of these goods are made that end up on our shelves, they're having COVID outbreaks, they're having downtimes. So you're getting running shoe manufacturers. Levi's talking about soaring cotton prices and ultimately saying, you know what, as a company, it's one thing for them to eat the cost, but why are they going to be benevolent? They're going to pass the cost on to you and me, the consumer. We're seeing soaring energy prices, fears about natural gas even influencing gasoline prices and crude prices. It's all just sort of conspiring against the consumer. And I'm not talking to anyone right now, Evan, who sees an end in sight to these price pressures. Transitory can mean whatever you want it to mean over a long enough time frame, can it?
Yeah, they keep calling it transitory, but there's no horizon on this. So what does it mean for interest rates for consumers? Because the tool to control inflation for the bank, crank up the interest rate.
Like you said, 6 months in a row we've been well above the bank's upper range. We're going to hear from the Bank of Canada next week. Now, would they have told us all through this, even as we are seeing these inflation prints month after month, they don't think they would be in a position in terms of the economic recovery to even think about raising rates until the second half of next year. That's not what we're hearing from the markets. That's not what we're hearing from economists. Earlier today on BNN Bloomberg, we had Derek Holt of Scotiabank on. He thinks we're in for eight interest rate hikes before the end of 2023, starting next July, four next year in just that span of the back half of the year, and then four more the year after that. That is going to change the game for a lot of people, particularly if you have a variable rate mortgage, which is, you know, getting priced off bank prime that goes back to the BOC. That could be a big sea change in terms of what we're paying for money in this country.
Yeah, and people are taking on debt, cheap money, a lot of borrowing. Let's see what happens. Okay, that is absolutely the story to watch right now. And I know we'll be talking about this for a long time. BNN Bloomberg's Greg Bunnell on the big inflation spike story. Thanks for that, Greg. So with the inflation issue making headlines, and it will, as Greg just said, for a long time, the cost of living is going up. You might think that parliamentarians would be scrambling to get back to work at that building behind me and get at all that pandemic recovery promises you heard so much about during the election. Not so fast. Parliament doesn't even return to business until November 22nd. And even then, some MPs might not even be able to legislate in person. Why? You got to be double vaxxed. That's right. There's something called the Board of Internal Economy. That's a group of MPs from all parties who have just met, and they've decided that everybody entering the House of Commons, everybody, including MPs, has to be fully vaccinated. People with a medical exemption will need to provide proof of a recent negative antigen test. The Liberals, the NDP and the Bloc, all say, no problem, all our MPs are fully vaccinated. The Conservatives disagree with the rule. Why? Well, how many of their MPs are fully vaccinated? No one knows. And what does the mandate mean for the future of a hybrid parliament, something Conservatives have never liked? Well, let's bring in some MPs to try to get some clarity. R. Ferrani is the Liberals' chief government whip. Blake Richards is the Conservative whip. He's also part of the Board of Internal Economy. Peter Julian, the NDP's House leader, also on that Board of Internal Economy, who decides some of these rules. Gents, first of all, welcome back. Good to have you. Mr. Richards, I've got to start with you because of the statement you've released, the Conservatives released. All MPs entering the House need to be fully vaccinated. You said your party disagrees with it. Can you explain why?
Well, we've said all along that we believe workplace safety, including in Parliament, can be assured by either vaccination or producing a negative rapid test. So we think that all members of Parliament can safely perform their duties in the House of Commons and in our committee rooms with either a vaccination or a rapid test. I think it's critically important that all members of Parliament are able to participate in person in those sessions and bring forward the really important issues that we need to be dealing with on behalf of our constituents.
But okay. Every single person that works in the House of Commons, all the staff, they have to be double vaccinated. To get on a plane, you have to be double vaccinated. To get on a bus, a train, you got to be double vaccinated. Can you tell us how many of the Conservative MPs exactly are double vaccinated and how many this is going to be a problem for?
Well, I think it's really up to each individual Canadian, including members of Parliament, to decide for themselves whether they want to disclose their personal health information. There are other legislatures, for example, in Canada. Ontario is doing this. Saskatchewan is doing this. There may be others as well, where, you know, in order to participate in the legislative chamber, you know, either showing a vaccination status or a negative rapid test. So we believe that it's worked in other jurisdictions. Why can't it be done for our parliament? I mean, what we're talking about here is it's the House of Commons. It's the very seat of democracy. People, thousands of Canadians have elected each of these members of Parliament to serve them, to represent them in the House of Commons. And we believe that it needs to be something that all members can do safely in person in the House of Commons, and that through rapid testing or vaccination.
Well, you could do it. I guess you could do it in a hybrid parliament, but your party opposes that. Mr. Ferrani, what do you make of Mr. Richards' claim that, look, I guess MPs should be an exception. They shouldn't have to declare if they're vaccinated. They should be able to just have a test. I guess that party views that as an equivalent, and they can do their job safely and serve the Canadians who elected them. What's your view?
Well, to be frank, I don't think much of what Mr. Richards just offered up to your viewers. To be frank, Evan, I think there's a difference between parliamentary privilege, which is meant to ensure vigorous and free and open debate so that we can pursue the best public policy possible for Canada, versus some sort of parliamentary entitlement or double standard. And when you're saying to Canadians that you need to be double dose vaccinated and be able to prove it in order to go about your daily activities, including going into restaurants, bars, sports stadiums, etc. When you're saying to federal civil servants, including the very same people who will be helping us to run and operate the House of Commons, that you need to be double dose vaccinated, I think it smacks of hypocrisy and inconsistency to carve out a special second double standard for parliamentarians. And in fact, there's no daylight between any of the parties on this except for the Conservative Party. The fact that Mr. Richards can't even answer a simple question that you just put to him that has been asked repeatedly of him and his leader for the past 6 to 8 weeks as to how many of their caucus is actually vaccinated is troubling, because it smacks of a lack of leadership, and it flies in the face of the best public health guidance, which is that we need people to be vaccinated. We need elected representatives to show leadership to promote others to be vaccinated. That is the way out of this pandemic and the way to produce better public policy and to meet the needs of the constituents that Mr. Richards professes to advocate for their interests.
Evan, to
Peter
be really
Julian,
clear,
you're
what,
part
we're,
of it.
What we're advocating here is exactly the same thing we're advocating for all Canadians. We think that we can assure workplace safety, including in Parliament, by vaccinations or by rapid testing. So,
but you know, companies, provinces, they all have vaccine mandates. You're saying the Conservative Party basically says there's an equivalent. Vaccines and testing are an equivalent tool for safety. That's essentially what you're saying. There's no difference between double vaccinated and getting tested. That's the Conservative position on it. That's the message you're going to go forward with.
What I want to make very clear is that we do believe that vaccines are the most important tool, and we encourage all Canadians to be vaccinated. That is an absolute something I want to
but
be very clear.
But not your own
with.
MPs.
What I'm saying is that we think that there is an alternative for people who aren't vaccinated to be able to rapid test to be able to ensure workplace safety. In Parliament, this is a place where critically important decisions are made on behalf of Canadians. We, you know, our leader Aaron O'Toole met with the Prime Minister earlier today, and he wants to address vaccine hesitancy. So we have some proposals we want to put forward before the House of Commons, but we really believe that all members of Parliament should have an opportunity to participate in those important discussions about that, about the economy, for example. Inflation, you just had someone on your program talking about the significant impacts of inflation. That's an issue we should be addressing in the House of Commons, but all members of Parliament should be able to participate.
And that's fair. I think every Canadian wants parliamentarians back to work. But Mr. Julian, first on the vaccine, and then we'll get to how fast Parliament's got to get back. But what do you make of the Conservatives' position that this is just unfair, that they could be tested and then they could come to Parliament? You're on the Board of Internal Economy, sir. What do you make of it?
I think it's a very strange position. I mean, we MPs have to set the example. We have to follow public health rules. And right now, Canadians line up when they go to a restaurant, when they're getting on a plane. They have to show proof of double vaccination, full vaccination. That's just something Canadians are doing. And so on the one hand, you have Conservatives saying, well, we shouldn't be subject to that. That's something that all Canadians are doing right now, and we're doing it in the best interests of the country. But on the other hand, they're also saying that they don't want to have the virtual tools that allow members of Parliament to participate fully, regardless of their circumstances, including a member of Parliament that has to be in quarantine. Over a two-week period. We believe all MPs should be participating. We've got the virtual tools. It costs millions of dollars to develop them. And it's just a strange position that the Conservatives are taking. On the one hand, not being subject to the same rules that other Canadians are subject to, but on the other hand, not even being interested in entertaining the solutions that allow for full participation and representation, regardless of what the MP situation is.
Evan, I think actually Peter's being a bit, I think Evan, Mr. Julian's being a bit polite. It's not strange. It's actually illogical. And there's also some misrepresentations. Mr. Richards purported to say that other legislatures are handling this. They are handling it. And there's only one reason for which a parliamentarian at a provincial level is not entitled to be vaccinated, and that's a medical exemption. And that is Premier Ford's response, and that is Premier Higgs' response. So not only is this anomalous as a position for a political party, it's anomalous amongst Conservatives. Another point that Mr. Richards has failed to address today or in previous instances is who should pay for the tests that would need to be done for people that have an ideological opposition to getting vaccinated. I think it's fair game to say that should be borne, that cost should not be borne by the taxpayers of Canada who are subjected to these very same rules around the country.
Well,
it should be borne by the individual people.
It's a moot point if they can't. Right, but it's a moot point if they can't get in with a test. But I just want to go back to Mr. Richards just real quick. And boy, I have so much to get through with the three of you, so I hope we get a chance to do this a little more. But Mr. Richards, I know you say it's not anyone's right to ask if your members are vaccinated. People ask when I go to a restaurant, they say, are you double vaccinated? Like literally everywhere we go, we're asked to show our proof. So it doesn't seem to be that big of an invasion of privacy since you can't do anything without these vaccine mandates. Now you're saying MP should be an exception on that, an exception. What happens then if they can't come? This is what I'm trying to figure out. November 22nd, you got a bunch of MPs that may not be vaccinated. You don't like a hybrid parliament. Will Conservative MPs participate in a hybrid parliament? or will they actually try to show up to work at the House of Parliament if they're not vaccinated?
Well, I mean, I think my hope is that obviously we can find a way to enable everyone to participate, and we believe. It isn't up to the Board of Internal Economy to make these decisions. Seven MPs making a decision in a secret meeting somewhere. Even former senior legal counsel for the House of Commons, Steve Chaplin, has come out and said that it really is a decision that Parliament should be making. So we're hoping that there's an appeal to reason here, that we want to see all members of Parliament be able to participate in the proceedings of the House of Commons and of its committees. And we believe it's best when those proceedings can happen in person. And so we hope that vaccines or rapid testing could be seen as the ways that we can enable that to happen and enable it to happen safely, making sure that everyone is kept safe, that their health is protected, but that all members of Parliament can participate equally in the proceedings of the House of Commons and of its committees.
I just have a risk of injecting facts in here. I just want to make sure our audience understands. The Board of Internal Economy has MPs from all parties, and I know Mr. Richard says it's secretive and seven MPs shouldn't make it. Under 9 years of Stephen Harper, the Board of Internal Economy functioned and was, quote, in camera and secretive, and it wasn't changed. In fact, it's only been changed since 2015. Yeah. So I just want to be fair. It was good enough under Mr. Harper, maybe not good enough now. No. Just a last word, Mr. Julian, real quick.
My point
is that the Conservatives have never questioned the Board of Internal Economy during all the years of the Harper majority, and of course, afterwards. This is the first time that there seems to be a question of the Board of Internal Economy. Of course, the board has the ability to put these health rules forward, and these are health rules that I think the vast majority of Canadians believe are important. MPs cannot be vectors for this fourth wave. And the reality is we're bringing people from across the country, including areas where there is a high degree of COVID transmission, we then go back to our ridings. Why should MPs take that risk on behalf of the public when there are smart health rules that we should be following?
To be fair, I got about 10 seconds for you. Mr. Richards, I know you wanted to respond real quick.
Yeah, it's not about questioning the Board of Internal Economy. They have the ability to make decisions about the precinct of Parliament. But when we're talking about potential privileges issues of members of Parliament, we believe that only the Parliament itself can pronounce on that. And that's what I'm talking about here. It's a very clear distinction.
There's so many other issues, when to cancel the CERB, when not to, when Parliament should come back. But I'm out of time here, but I'd love to have you back tomorrow because these are consequential issues. I always appreciate your time, Mr. Varani, Mr. Richards, and Mr. Julian. Thanks, gents. I really appreciate the debates and the conversation. Good to see you all. Coming up, though, Canada's first sugar tax, Newfoundland and Labrador wants to tax sugary drinks. Will that province prove to be a sweet example for the rest of the country, or is this a sugary and maybe even a sour cash grab? We'll find out next. Do governments have businesses in the beverages of the country? Well, Newfoundland and Labrador said, yeah, they're going to implement Canada's first tax targeting sugary drinks in 2022. About 50 countries around the world have already have some kind of sugar tax of their own, including the UK. The government says Newfoundland and Labrador spends almost 3% of its annual food and drink expenditure on sugary drinks. That's the highest rate in the country. So to curb that, the province is proposing a 20 cents per liter tax on sugary drinks. The government in that province says the tax will bring in about $9 million a year. So will this make a healthier province, or is this just, I don't know, a sickly sweet cash grab? Let's find out. Joining me now, the Premier of Newfoundland and Labrador, Andrew Fury. Premier Dr. Fury, always a pleasure. Okay, well, this is it. The first sugar tax in Canada. Is 20 cents per liter enough? Like, tell me where this comes from. What's the idea behind this tax on sugar?
Sure. I mean, it's really a policy decision driven at changing people's behaviors. We recognize this isn't going to generate an incredible amount of revenue, but we also recognize as leaders in Newfoundland and Labrador, we spend the most per person per year on healthcare of any jurisdiction in the country, yet we have the worst health outcomes. We have the highest burden of disease. We have the lowest life expectancy. And one of the complicating comorbidities in that is diabetes. We have a prevalence here in Newfoundland and Labrador of about 10%. And that costs the system over $28 million a year. And that's not including, lost opportunity costs from employment and missing work and so on. So we recognize that we need to shift people in the right direction. So we thought that the sugar tax on beverages was an important way to nudge people in the right direction when making that selection at the point of purchase. And we've seen it in other jurisdictions, Evan. I mean, we've seen it in the UK. We've seen how it can work. There was a recent British Medical Journal article summarizing the impact there. And we know that it can have an impact on reducing consumption of sugar, which, of course, leads to obesity and other comorbidities.
So how much is the tax? Let's get it. So if I buy a can of Coke, what do I pay before the tax and what do I pay now?
It's based on 20 cents per liter. So that would be collected at the wholesale level. And any revenues that we do generate from this, what we would do with that is we'd use it either in an education campaign at the point of purchase to ensure that people are recognizing the calories that they're purchasing. We'd use it for Kids Eat Smart program and others like that to ensure that there are healthy options for, those who can't afford it, particularly on an island where, sometimes produce, et cetera, can be quite expensive. And we would use it to help diabetes and diabetic education. So, it's 20 cents per liter, and that's applied at the wholesale level.
Okay, so here's what it applies to. Soft drinks, soda pop, sparkling fruit juices, carbonated energy drinks, so I guess your Gatorade, kombucha. I don't even know what that is, but I thought that was healthy. Now I guess that's it. You got sweetened coffee. Now, yep. Apparently also frozen desserts and ice cream.
Well, the frozen desserts are into the beverages, as I understand it. So the slushies and the things like that.
It says candy or chocolate, but you're not charging. Is this a candy bar tax or a
not a candy bar tax. No, everyone's okay for Halloween. We had to start somewhere, and we think that the sweetened beverage tax that we've seen in other jurisdictions around the world, including Spain, France, and the UK, but well studied in the UK, was a good place to start.
Okay, you know today the inflation rate hit 4.4% in September. Food is a big contributor to that jump. You think this is the right time to add a tax on things, make some cheap drinks more expensive?
Well, no, we're giving people options, right? We're saying, we're not saying that you can't buy the regular sugar content drink. We're saying if you're going to do that, we recognize that that has an external impact on the healthcare system. Subsequently, you should pay probably a little bit more for that. You have another option where you can buy a low sugar content drink, and that's an equal choice. And what they found in that British Medical Journal article just this year in 2021 is that the consumption of sodas, if you will, didn't change. What did change was there was a decrease by about 10% of sugar-related soda drinks. So people just made a different choice. And that's why it's not really – it's more of a behavior modification policy instrument than it is a revenue-generating
tool. To modify behavior, you got to send a certain – there's got to be a threshold of a price signal. And is 20 cents per liter enough of a price signal, a strong enough disincentive to discourage consumers from buying sugar drinks? Is it too much or is it enough? Like, how do you land on that?
Well, pardon the pun, but we think we hit on the sweet spot.
Tax you for that answer, 20% on your words.
I'd pay it happily. No, we think we're in a good spot, but of course this is new. This is a new frontier in Canada, and so we recognize that we may have had to adapt and change along the way. But one of the things I did say earlier, and one of the things we're committed to doing, is any revenue that's generated there, we will take that and use it for educational tools at the point of purchase. So as we're all familiar with now in places like New York City, and you're seeing it more and more in Tim Hortons around the country, there's calorie counts listed. Well, we're equally looking at using whatever revenue is generated there to apply to the point of purchase so that there are decals, for example, when you go to pick up a regular, I don't want to use a brand name, but a full sugar drink and a diet drink, then you have that glaring in your face so that, there is a further behavior modification.
So you expect this to grab $9 million, and the $9 million a year will go toward that education. Now, you just said something to me, Premier, that I'm interested in. You said we had to start somewhere. Is that what people can expect? Okay, sugar tax starts on beverages. Now we're going to get chocolate bar tax. Then we're going to get the sodium tax. Then there's the fat. I'm serious because these have all been proposed. There's science to back up too much fast food. So here we go. You're going to tax my McDonald's, tax my Halloween candy, tax my Coca-Cola. And then suddenly, you know, does the government have business in the kitchens of the nation?
No, I mean, that's not where we're headed. But we, you know, we recognize that we have a health problem here in Newfoundland and Labrador. As I said from the outset, we're spending the most, but we have the worst health outcomes. And part of the contributing component to that is diabetes. Sugar, we know, excess sugar drinks and obesity contributes to the diabetic impacts of our citizens. So we are asking people, we're disincentivizing the choice of the sugar drink. And then they have other options available to them. We're going to see how this lands. Hopefully it changes behavior, which ultimately drives outcomes, which we saw in the UK. The UK, of course, in that BGA, in the British Medical Journal, which I've already said, reduced consumption by 10%. They equate that in an extrapolated formulation to about a 1% reduction in the prevalence of diabetes. So, you know, that's not insignificant when you're talking about a population of 525,000 people.
No, it's interesting. I wonder if any other provinces follow suit. Premier, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you, sir.
Take care, Evan.
Coming up, the Governor General's first international trip. Mary Mae Simon is in Germany on a trip that includes a stop at the world's largest trade book fair. CTV's Annie Bergeron Oliver joins us from Germany next. Stay with us. Governor General Mary Mae Simon is on her first international trip, a state visit to Germany. Part of it means opening the Frankfurt Book Fair. It's the largest book fair in the world. CTV's Annie Bergeron Oliver is on the road with her, and she actually got a chance to sit down with the Governor General earlier today. How does the Governor General view her new role? Is she already thinking about what she represents? Well, let's find out. Joining me now from Frankfurt, Germany, is CTV's Annie Bergeron Oliver. Annie, you spoke with the Governor General, Mary Mae Simon, for the first time today. You talked, obviously, about reconciliation. What did she say about her role as GG?
Well, the Governor General said that she sees her role as really bridging a gap between governments and Indigenous people. And she said there are a lot of difficult conversations in the future. She says these are conversations that need to happen. She says her goal is really to develop a better understanding between Indigenous people and the government. Here's a clip from that interview about what she had to say the path to reconciliation looks like in Canada right now.
I have an important role to play. And it's, yes, of course, to help bridge some of the gaps and to bring about better understanding between Indigenous peoples and governments. And I think that role is very important because without that understanding, without the work that is necessary, reconciliation is going to be a very slow process. It's a lifelong process, but we somehow have to speed it up a bit. Without being disrespectful to those that have been done harm to.
Okay, and Annie, what about what her role means? It's a little early to talk about her legacy, but the resonance of her position right now.
She says that her legacy really isn't personal, that ultimately what she wants to do is ensure that the work she does over this term as Governor General provides lasting change for generations to come, whether that's on reconciliation or other issues. She says really that is the goal. Here's what she had to say about that when I asked the question.
I want to leave a legacy where we have done significant work in those areas that will go way beyond my term as Governor General. It should not depend on me being in that position. It has to go way beyond going on and on addressing different issues. It'll take different shapes in the future.
Okay, Annie Bergeron Oliver on the very first trip with the Governor General, Mary Mae Simon, in Frankfurt, Germany. Annie, great to have you on the program. Thanks.
Thanks, Evan.
Coming up, inflation on the rise after a year and a half of living through a COVID crisis. Canadians also have to contend with a rising cost of living big time. When will Canadians be able to catch a break? The Press Gallery talked about the politics of inflation, the politics of vaccines, and lots more. Stay right here with Power Play. Back to Power Play, the Prime Minister has met with Jagmeet Singh, and here's Jagmeet Singh now with what happened inside that meeting.
How important it is for us to see immediate supports for frontline healthcare workers who are burnt out, who are struggling right now, who are in untenable work conditions because of staff shortages. So we want to see an immediate injection of supports to help out provinces, people that are needing care, and those frontline healthcare workers. I also outlined that for New Democrats, there is no question. We need to see the Liberal government and Justin Trudeau stop taking Indigenous kids to court. There is no reason to be appealing this decision, and we've long called on the government to stop fighting kids in court, work out a settlement, negotiate with the community, with First Nations, but fighting them in court is the wrong thing to do. We also outlined, for me, another priority for us and our team is to see immediate supports for Iqaluit in Nunavut, where we know that the community is going through a water crisis and they need supports. We also talked about, I outlined the importance of seeing a response to the inflation. People right now are having a hard time and it's getting harder because the cost of groceries is going up, the cost of housing is going up, and we need to see some steps to address the rising cost of living and the inflation. And finally, I outline for New Democrats, it is very important for us to see some action, real action on the climate crisis. Things are getting worse and worse, and Canada is not doing its part. Justin Trudeau has failed on a number of these really key points to reduce emissions, to end fossil fuel subsidies, and to lay out a clear plan with investments to ensure that workers have a bright future. We want to see those commitments, particularly with COP coming up. This is an opportunity for us to see some real action on the climate crisis. Action on these things would indicate to New Democrats a willingness to work together, and we would respond in kind. And that's something that's really important. I want to make sure that's clear. New Democrats want to work together. We want to make Parliament work for Canadians, but the Liberals cannot take our support for granted.
Donc aujourd'hui, j'ai eu une conversation avec le Premier ministre Justin Trudeau et j'ai mentionné, j'ai partagé les priorités pour nous comme parti.
We have as a party and the priorities that we want to see concrete action on to show a will to work together. So we said we want to see right away action. Concrete action for investments in healthcare, frontline workers for the future, the frustration due to the pandemic. So we need urgent and rapid investment to help our frontline workers. Also, it's essential for us to help people. The CERB is essential. At this time, with COVID-19, we want to continue financial help for people. Also, the Liberal government and Justin Trudeau must stop immediately lawsuits against Indigenous children in the courts. He has to stop the lawsuits against Indigenous children right away. We also said we want aid for the communities in Nunavut because they have a drinking water crisis at this time. We also said we wanted to see action to deal with the inflation. It's also an urgency because the cost of life is going up and people can't afford to make ends meet, and it's even harder because of this inflation. Finally, we said we want to see concrete action to deal with the climate crisis, particularly with COP coming up. We want to see concrete action to stop subsidies to oil and gas and invest in good jobs that reduce emissions and other actions to reduce our emissions. These are our priorities. We want concrete action. It'll show a will to work together.
Thank you, Jagmeet. I would just ask that you use the raise hand function, please, and there'll be one question and one follow-up question. Je vous demande d'utiliser la fonction lever la main pour poser des questions et une question suivie, s'il te plaît. So I think first we have Catherine Levesque. Go ahead.
Oui, bonjour, Monsieur Singh.
First question. I wanted to bring up the CERB again. The NDP thinks it should last until when? And what was Mr. Trudeau's response when you asked him to extend it? I think we should extend to until the pandemic ends, or we have an alternative with EI that works. As you know, employment insurance is not working for the vast majority of people, which means that 60% of Canadians cannot access employment insurance. So we really need to change that. And we have to also continue to help people until people no longer need this help. It's clear with the fourth wave, with the situation in Alberta and Saskatchewan, which is really still in crisis, and people continue to need help. And I also wanted to ask you about vaccines for MPs. One office made a decision yesterday. What do you think of the Conservatives who are opposed and that accept, simply do not accept the decision that was made? I think the decision was the right one. It's clear we need to protect workers who work on the Hill and other MPs. So the importance of being vaccinated, there's no doubt. So I agree with the decision, and I don't understand why the Conservatives are opposed, and I will continue to say clearly that we will have a safe and healthy work environment, which means everyone has to be vaccinated.
Thank you. Next, we have David Thurton from CBC.
Hi, Mr. Singh. Thanks for taking our questions. The question I just want to ask you is maybe if you can just, I know you've been asked this a million times, but just if you could just state maybe what are your top policy areas that you think your party and the Liberals are in agreement with? And what priorities are you prepared to work quickly with the government on, in the next couple of months?
Well, I want to be really clear on this. There are things that the Liberals have said that they're interested in doing that we believe in very firmly that we need to do. And I'm concerned that they often say the right things but don't do it. So I'll lay out some of the things that we've said and that the Liberals have said that they support. But again, we're not going to hold our breath. We want to see some actions. Paid sick leave. 22 times over the past 18 months, we said there needs to be paid sick leave in this country. There needs to be no question about a worker getting sick, whether they can go into work, whether they have to go into work sick because they don't have paid sick leave and they don't have enough support to be able to pay their bills at the end of the month. So that's something that we really believe in. After saying no 22 times, now Mr. Trudeau in the middle of the campaign said he's interested in it. We want to see action on that. That's something that would signify a willingness to work together. We've long said that for us, childcare is, of course, vital, essential. We want to see the job finished. We're ready to work on that. I outlined a number of the other concerns. We want to see financial supports continue, not just the CRB. We also want to see paid sick leave, the caregiver supports continue. We want to see those financial supports continue. We want to see small businesses continue to receive things like the wage subsidy. We want to make sure that those supports are tied directly to work and workers, but we think that those supports are really important for a lot of small businesses. We've said that healthcare is important, and so as the Liberals, but we want to see a commitment to helping people right now while we know there are staff shortages for frontline healthcare workers. We want to see those those staff shortages and the investments made immediately so that we can help people out. We mentioned a number of times how important for New Democrats it is to fight the climate crisis. We know that people are so worried about this. Kids are worried about the future. People are feeling the impacts right now. We just came out of a summer of intense forest fires across the country. We need to act now to tackle the climate crisis. And with COP coming up, there's an opportunity to signal whether or not Mr. Trudeau is willing to work together by his actions and commitment to reducing emissions. We want to see that. Those are some of the key priorities. We also said we want to see this government immediately stop fighting Indigenous kids in court. There is no way that can continue. And if they stop fighting these kids in court, that would be a signal of a willingness to work together. And those are some of our top immediate priorities.
And so what would be the first piece of legislation that you would like to see come before the House?
Well, the pressing thing right now is continuing the financial supports for people. There are a lot of people right now that are up against a deadline. They do not have any other way of putting food on the table. They rely on the CRB. To cut that would be horrible for a lot of people. And it would really signify to us that Mr. Trudeau is sending a message. He's not wanting to work together. So we're going to watch closely and see what happens with the supports that people need. In addition to that is the immediate healthcare crisis. There's a lot of people right now that are worried about our healthcare system being with a lot of healthcare workers at their limit. And we want to see an injection of support to keep the staffing levels at the level they need to be and to immediately help out in this crisis. So those are some of the things that are really urgent and immediate. Paid sick leave fits into that as well as some immediate things that we can deal with.
Okay, our next question.
Okay, that's Jagmeet Singh following his meeting with Justin Trudeau. Mr. Trudeau also met with Mr. O'Toole, Ms. May, and met with the Bloc yesterday. As Mr. Singh just outlined, his key priorities, supporting healthcare workers in the province, a promise not to appeal that federal court decision to compensate Indigenous kids who were in the child care services from 2006, $40,000 each, a response to inflation. He urged the PM to extend the COVID support programs like CERB, which run out late this week. Remember, the Prime Minister will need opposition support, and the NDP have the Liberals been their main dance partner to date, and looks like they still will be because he doesn't want to go back to an election. But this meeting comes as Canadians are struggling, as we said, with sky-high inflation. StatsCan says Canada's annual inflation rate is the highest since 2003. So what does it mean for the recovery? Should federal support programs be stopped? And what about the Conservatives not accepting the decision by Parliament to get all MPs double vaxxed before Parliament returns November 22nd? The press gallery has been patiently waiting. Tonda McCharles, a senior reporter with the Toronto Star's Ottawa Bureau, is here. Carl Dockstader, co-host of One Dish, One Mic, executive director of the Niagara Regional Native Centre, is here. And our special guest, Mustafa Askari, chief economist at the Institute of Fiscal Studies and Democracy, formerly of the PBO. Okay, thanks for your patience, everyone. Tonda, let me just quickly start with you. Because the politics, Prime Minister met with Jagmeet Singh, Aaron O'Toole, the Green Party. Among the issues, when Parliament's going to come back, when are these programs going to be extended? And I guess the first thing is, are Conservatives even going to get to go if they don't get double vax? Mm-hmm. What do you make of that, these bouquet of issues emerging today?
What a bouquet. In some respects, it feels a little bit like Yogi Berra said, deja vu all over again, a little bit of a replay of the election campaign, frankly. But look, I'm interested in one of the big things sort of right up front for the government that's about to get underway, I guess, in a month from now, that there's already flashpoints here. And so, look, for the Conservatives, I think that ultimately they're going to face a problem in the House of Commons because the MPs can vote themselves by a majority vote to require vaccinations for in-person presence within the Commons precinct. So that's going to be one big thing. But Jagmeet Singh, it was interesting what he was just saying there. Like, immediately one of the things that the government has to decide is whether or not to continue pandemic benefits to individuals. And I think they've been showing some reluctance about that. They're very conscious of arguments that the Bloc has been making around labor shortages and, you know, some of that, even though the evidence may or may not be spotty. everybody on that. But Jagmeet Singh wants these benefits to continue until the end of the pandemic. I think that the Liberal government is privately somewhat reluctant to continue them ad infinitum. And the Conservatives want them ended immediately. So, by the way, does the Bloc Québécois. So right away, we're going to see some of the same flashpoints we saw in the campaign.
Yeah, Carl, to jab or not to jab, that means work or not work. And then I think Ton is exactly right. On the CERB, which is an urgent issue, NDP, don't end them. Conservatives today urge Mr. Trudeau, end them, end the CERB. What's your take on how this breaks down, Carl?
Yeah, I mean, what I was really listening for and what I've been listening for is to hear something different, both from the recent campaign, but even from the legislature before they broke for the campaign. And I don't know that Jagmeet said anything just now to differentiate the NDP from the course that they've been on for a little while. I do think that the Conservatives are going to take a bit of a hit for standing up for not having everybody be vaccinated. So that'll be a little bit of differentiation. But there's still a lot of questions to be answered. I'll also be interested to see if there's anything coming up with the cabinet shuffle that's going to be different this time around.
Yeah, we'll find out that on Tuesday. But listen, if the Conservatives are vulnerable in terms of asking their MPs who's vaccinated or not, Mustafa. Meantime, the Liberals have this big pandemic recovery promise and inflation's hit 4.5%. They got to figure out if they're going to extend these very consequential, expensive programs like the CERB. Should Canadians be A, concerned about the rise of inflation, and B, does that impact decisions on COVID supports?
Well, with Canadians should be concerned about inflation if it becomes a permanent problem. But I'm sure you have heard from others, and especially the governor of the Bank of Canada, that the expectation is that these price increases are temporary, transitory. And because we went through the COVID crisis last year and prices were down, so when you compare the prices in September this year to September of last year, certainly you're going to see a big jump because there's a catch-up effect. One way to look at this, actually, is to look at the prices, not relative to last year, but relative to 2 years ago. And when you do that, actually, the average inflation rate over the past 2 years is about 2.4%. It's not 4.4%. 4.4% is really because of the comparison between this September to last September, which was right in the middle of the lockdown. So there is a bit of an issue with those numbers. Now, certainly, if inflation becomes a major problem, then that should be a concern for the government in terms of how they would support people through pandemic and through their COVID support.
Yeah, Tonda, I mean, I know the bank keeps saying inflation is transitory, and you look up, it's been going up for 6 months, and I think most of us right, it's going up compared to last year when things were, there was depressed pricing, but people are going to the pumps and the grocery store and it's a bloody high price there. So does this pose a political problem for Justin Trudeau, and does it impact how he has to figure out what to do with stimulus planning?
It's a challenge, it's a political challenge to deflect opposition demands by the Conservatives, for example, that he ditch all his programs and all his supports for individuals. It's a challenge for him to politically explain what the government's role will be in dealing with some of the supply issues, no question. But look, I think I'm going to go with the inflation expert on this panel and say, you know, the fact if the numbers are indeed transitory, and if they are compared to 2 years ago, what he says, not something that the Bank of Canada is going to jump in on immediately. I think that Trudeau might be able to ride the wave a little longer and get through this initial, you know, the next few months where we see what is going to shake out with, for example, recovery. Will vaccination rates increase further? Will we be able to open up properly and see people back at work and some semblance of normality after this?
Yeah, well, I remember a buddy lent me a dog, and he said it was just be transitory. The dog stayed 6 months. It felt like forever. All right, Carl, Tonda, and Mustafa, great to have you all three on the program. Thanks so much. We got a little cut short today. That is your Power Play Day in politics. Thanks so much for watching. Remember, hug your